And we're now in public session. I'd like to welcome Mr. Tim Duggan, Assistant Secretary at the Department of Employment Affairs and Social Protection, accompanied by Claire Dowling. And I'd also like to welcome Joan Gordon, Chief Appeals Officer, accompanied by Mr. Brian Duff. I'll invite our guests in a few moments to make their opening statements, and then members will have an opportunity to ask a number of questions. Before that, I wish to draw your attention to the fact that by virtue of Section 17(2)(l) of the Defamation Act 2009, witnesses are protected by absolute privilege in respect of their evidence to this committee. However, if you're directed by the committee to cease giving evidence in relation to a particular matter, and you continue to so do, you're entitled thereafter only to a qualified privilege in respect of your evidence. You're directed that only evidence connected with the subject matter of these proceedings is to be given, and you're asked to respect the parliamentary practice to the effect that, where possible, you should not criticise or make charges against any person, persons or entity by name or in such a way as to make him, her or it identifiable. And members are reminded of the long-standing parliamentary practice to the effect that they should not comment on, criticise or make charges against a person outside the Houses or an official, either by name or in such a way as to make him or her identifiable. And once again, colleagues, if you've mobile phones, you might turn them either to flight mode or turn them off, please. Mr. Duggan, would you like to start with your opening statement, please?
Thank you very much, Chairman, and my thanks to the committee for the invitation to appear today. The scope section of the department makes decisions or determinations in respect of a range of PRSI-related matters for which our deciding officers have a number of powers and functions under the Social Welfare Consolidation Act 2005 as amended. One of the determinations our deciding officers can make is in relation to a person's employment status. In other words, we can decide whether a worker or former worker is or was an employee or is or was self-employed. And from that decision flows the appropriate categorisation for PRSI purposes, the most common, of course, being Class A for an employee and Class S for a self-employed person. Cases that involve decisions on employment status may arise from requests from employers, from employees, employer representative groups, employee representative groups, the department's own social welfare inspectors, departmental officials working in central social welfare scheme areas, or even from the revenue commissioners on occasion. Of the cases scope section deals with each year, those involving the employment status of workers constitute a very small proportion. For example, of the 1,000 or so decisions made by scope section so far this year, only about 5% of those relate to employment status. When a request for a determination on employment status is received, the scope officials will do some checks to see if there are any prior relevant records. Then the relevant parties will be contacted. The case is typically referred to one of the department's social welfare inspectors in the relevant geographical region, who will conduct further in-depth and usually in-person checks. When the relevant factual information or evidence is returned, our deciding officers then make a determination based on the law. In every case, the decision is an individual one, and in every case, the decision may be appealed to the Social Welfare Appeals Office. As the Chief Appeals Officer may outline, there are further avenues of recourse after that. I want to assure the committee that no individual worker who seeks a decision from scope section is turned away. I also want to assure the committee that there are no group decisions, but only individual decisions. Each case turns on its own facts, and the law is applied without fear or favour to those facts. Our deciding officers are guided by their own statutory powers and the case law that has evolved in the courts over many decades now. An important guide for them is the Code of Practice for Determining Employment or Self-Employment Status of Individuals, which was originally developed in the early 2000s and has been amended since. It is being updated now again by an interdepartmental working group consisting of our department, Revenue, and the Workplace Relations Commission. The new guidance on determining employment status, as it will be called, does not create new law. It only reflects the up-to-date position as it has emerged in the court and in legislation. It sets out the key tests or factors that have been found by the courts to determine whether a person is employed or self-employed. In this regard, the courts have found that the determination as to the appropriate insurability classification must be arrived at by looking at what a person actually does, the way in which it is done, and the terms and conditions under which the person is engaged, be they written, verbal or implied. It is also clear from the relevant case law that there is no one factor which may be taken as determinative of either state. And next, the final draft of those updated guidance is ready to go to the social partners for their observations in the very near future. And Minister Doherty has already highlighted how she intends to put this revised guidance on a statutory footing next year once it is completed. We're acutely aware of the allegedly increasing prevalence of false self-employment in the Irish economy. However, the numbers around us are frankly not compelling. Figures from the CSO show that the number of self-employed workers as a proportion of all workers in Ireland has remained largely stable for over 20 years. In fact, the most recent figures from the Labour Force survey show a slight drop in the number of self-employed persons, as well as a slight decrease in the number of self-employed people with no paid employees. And it is these self-employed people with no paid employees who are the most obvious candidates for the false self-employment label. However, we know this figure is not increasing, as some have suggested. Nevertheless, regardless of these facts and figures, it is the case that concrete examples of false self-employment have been found, and it does exist. Additionally, it is absolutely, in the view of the Department, a worthwhile and important enterprise to reduce the number of persons who are incorrectly or fraudulently categorised as being self-employed when they are in fact operating as employees. The Department takes this very seriously. As a consequence, we are engaged in an intensive nationwide inspection and compliance campaign to understand better the prevalence of this issue, to identify sectors where it may be a particular problem, and to tackle and reduce any instances of it. In that regard, we have firstly increased resources in scope section. Secondly, we have set up a new inspection unit called the Employment Status Inspection Unit, which is dedicated to inspecting employer PRSI and the classification of workers. Thirdly, our inspectors nationwide are conducting employer inspections at an increasing rate, some of which are done jointly with Revenue and the Workplace Relations Commission. Fourthly, legislative provisions are being developed to encourage workers to apply to scope section for clarity about their employment status. These are anti-victimisation measures that will allow workers to make a complaint to the WRC if they are victimised by employers because they sought a determination from scope section. Fifthly, the Minister is seeking to introduce a new specific criminal offence of the deliberate and knowing misclassification of a worker as being self-employed, which will carry appropriate penalties. While it is unlikely to be possible to ever eradicate false self-employment, the Department is committed to minimising its potential and to detecting and dealing with it wherever it does occur. This is critically important because it has a twofold benefit. Firstly, it reduces leakage on the Social Insurance Fund, which pays for a wide range of social protection schemes. And secondly, it gives workers access to our robust employment rights legislation. I hope the steps I've set out here demonstrate the Department's determination in this regard. And Claire and I will endeavour to answer any questions that members may have. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for your opening statement, Mr. Duggan. Ms. Gordon, if you'd like to make yours, please.
Thank you, Chairman, committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to address you today. By way of background, I'd like to say the Appeals Office was established in 1990, is headed by a Chief Appeals Officer and has its own appeals officers who are independent in their decision-making. The role of the Office is to determine appeals against decisions of deciding officers, and the legislation governing the appeals process is contained in the Social Welfare Act 2005 and regulations made thereunder. While the legislation provides that a decision of an appeals officer is final and conclusive, a number of routes for review and revision, including references and appeals to the courts, are also provided for in the legislation. All decisions of appeals officers and revised decisions of the Chief Appeals Officer are subject to judicial review, and the Ombudsman can examine complaints about everyday administrative activities carried out by the office. The appeals process is quasi-judicial, with appeals officers being required to decide all appeals on a de novo basis. While the issues that are dealt with on appeal are based on the provisions of the 2005 Act and the regulations, the Office is not a court but must observe the principles of natural justice and fair procedures. Appeals may be disposed of by way of summary decision or by means of an oral hearing. It is a matter for the Appeals Officer to decide if a case can properly be determined without an oral hearing. Decisions of Appeals Officers are made on the facts pertaining to the individual case. The decisions do not create precedents, however, the Office strives to achieve consistency in its decision making. Turning to the specific issue of determining the status of a worker for social insurance purposes, Section 300, subsection 2 of the 2005 Act gives statutory power to deciding officers of the Department to determine questions relating to the insurability of employment for social insurance purposes. All such decisions can be appealed under the provisions of Section 311 of the 2005 Act. Appeals relating to employment status cover a range of issues, including directors of companies, family employments, partnerships and public sector employments. The number of cases involving the determination as to whether a person was employed under a contract of service or a contract for services is relatively small. There is no legislative provision which provides for appeals officers to make decisions on the employment status of groups or classes of workers who are engaged or operate on the same terms and conditions. However, it is also the case that the legislation does not preclude such an approach. Excuse me. I have occasionally, and usually where a number of workers engaged by the same employer are concerned and have individually submitted an appeal, been asked to make decisions on a sample number of cases. I have agreed to this approach in very limited circumstances and only with the agreement of both the employer and the workers concerned. However, I wish to emphasise that each worker is entitled to an individual decision on their appeal. The approach can be an efficient way of dealing with issues that are common in appeal cases and where there are a number of workers attached to an appeal. However, the approach cannot compromise the integrity of the appeal process or deny an interested party the opportunity of having any evidence particular to their appeal being considered by an appeals officer. I can advise that this approach has not been adopted during my time as Chief Appeals Officer since 2015 in the case of an appeal where the classification of a worker as an employee or self-employed person is the issue under appeal. However, I am aware that an appeals officer proposed this approach in a case where a number of workers engaged by a specific employer was concerned. The parties to that appeal were not happy to proceed on that basis, and the appeals officer proceeded to determine the appeals in each individual case. I have outlined that all appeals are determined on a case-by-case basis and on the particular facts of each appeal. While appeal decisions do not themselves create precedents, the office endeavours to be consistent in its decision-making and strives to ensure that the same conclusion is reached in cases that are based on the same or similar factual circumstances. In the case of appeals on the insurability of employment, consistency is achieved by applying the precedents emerging from the case law of the courts and by reference to the code of practice for determining employment and self-employment status of individuals. The office does not categorise cases as bogus self-employment or false self-employment, and the office is only concerned with determining if a worker is correctly classified as an employee or a self-employed person. It is also the case that appeals officers cannot be concerned about the implications arising from their decisions, and the Supreme Court has said that appeals officers are required to be free and unrestricted in discharging their functions. Where an appeal against the decision of a deciding officer and a worker status is received, notification of that appeal and the grounds of appeal are provided to the other interested parties. Those interested parties are invariably the worker, the company or companies that engage the worker, and the scope section of the department. All parties are afforded full opportunity to make submissions on the appeal contentions, and if an oral hearing is convened, all parties are notified and requested to attend. The appeal decision is issued to all these interested parties. Any party to the appeal, including the appellant, and in addition to recourse to the courts or the Ombudsman's Office, can invoke the provisions of the 2005 Act providing for the revision of the appeals officer's decision based on new facts or evidence and/or error of fact or law. Turning to some statistics, the Department processes around 2 million new claims each year. About 85% of these are successful. By comparison, some 19,000 appeals have been made to the Social Welfare Appeals Office to the end of October this year. And the figure in 2018 full year was 18,854. Of this number in 2019, 57 relate to appeals against decisions made by deciding officers in the scope section of the department covering a range of issues. 26 of these 57 appeals relate specifically to the question of whether a person was employed under a contract of service or a contract for services. A total of 41 appeals were determined by the office in the period from the 1st of January 2018 to the end of October 2019 relating to the question of whether a person was employed under a contract of service or a contract for services. And Brian and I will be pleased to take any questions members may have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gordon. Just one general question, Mr. Duggan, if you don't mind me, and then colleagues. You say that you have engaged, the department has engaged in an intensive nationwide inspection and compliance campaign. You say we've this year increased resources in scope section. You've set up a new unit called the Employment Status Inspection Unit, and that's all very positive and to be welcomed. I'd like you maybe to give an understanding to the committee of the numbers of people involved. Like you have increased resources to the scope section, so in terms of staff assigned to either the new unit or the scope section, and maybe the number of cases that has been determined this year in comparison to last year. In other words, since you have increased the resources, what are we seeing?
Okay, so the scope section had 5 deciding officers at the beginning of the year. It now has 8, so almost double. The new employment status investigation unit, which didn't exist at all at the beginning of the year, has got 4 inspectors right now. We're hoping to increase that to 6 before the end of the year. And I have management board approval to extend it out to 12 and perhaps 15 if the demand levels warrant that over the next while. There's quite a bit of work in setting it up because we need to train people in quite complicated area of law, and therefore it takes a while to get somebody from being assigned to being productive in a unit like that. But we are working on that. We also are leveraging the 350 social welfare inspectors that are deployed nationwide as part of this effort. So there's been quite a lot of training and refamiliarisation with this area of law done over the course of the year. And more attention is being paid by social welfare inspectors on the ground to employer and PRSI inspections specifically. I think it's fair to acknowledge that over the course of the economic recession, the concentration by social welfare inspection was on scheme-related issues rather than on this, but we're now trying to rebalance that. So in 2018, there were just over 2,000 employer investigations. And so up to the end of October, that has increased to 2,745 that have now been completed, and we have almost 1,000 others underway. And there probably will be a few more from October to the end of December. So it won't be quite a doubling, but close enough a doubling, I think, when we do the final figures after the year end.
And in terms of, from those investigations in particular, when we refer then to people who are miscategorised in terms of their employment, what are you finding there?
As I said in my opening statement, the numbers aren't big at all. So we've had 60 cases that we've dealt with this year, specifically in relation to the employment status of individuals. Of those 60, 40 have been determined to be employees, and 20 have been determined as self-employed. So a sort of a 2-to-1 split in those 60. And then, as the Chief Appeals Officer has said, about 26 of those have gone to appeal. So one of the features of this area of law is that decisions are often appealed, unlike most other scheme areas of the department.
And one final question of that, and sorry to colleagues, but of that 60, those 60 cases, how many of those did you find resulted from your investigations and your inspectors, or how many resulted from people approaching scope section?
That's very much a mixed bag. We get referrals from various sources. Could be revenue, could be our own inspectors, could be our new inspectors, could be employers, could be employees, representative groups on either side. So I think that's fairly evenly split across. I think there's a slight lead on employees themselves seeking a determination. So what is my status?
So of that 60, would it be fair for the committee to assume that 30 were employees who approached scope with an issue? No.
No, I don't have that exact figure. I can try and interrogate the...
You know where we're coming from. Yeah. Like I suppose what we're trying to get to is you have increased resources, you have proactively, and we're supportive of that and acknowledging that. I suppose we're trying to determine what that is yielding. And just on that cohort of 60 cases, how many were found by your inspectors and the efforts that you were making versus individuals who have come forward to complain about their own status?
Yeah, we'll interrogate the data.
If you can.
Send you a note.
You know what we're trying to get
at?
Yeah,
no, I will. And we'll send you a note to try and break that down for you. But it tends to be split across the four or five different referral points that can come reasonably.
It would just give us an idea.
Yeah.
Because, as you say, you know, in terms of the new unit, the additional staff, the increase in staff and the scope section and so forth. So we'd like to see where that was going. And I fully understand that the new unit was only set up from this summer on and training and so forth. But year on year, we should be able to track and monitor what has happened. You know, it would give a good idea. And I fully accept it's year one. It won't have a full year of operation. But we need to monitor what the outcomes are. Okay. Senator Nash.
Yeah, you're all very welcome indeed to the committee here this morning, and I'd prefer, if possible, with the permission of the chair, maybe to ask maybe a number of questions and actually have a dialogue. I think that would be probably more productive. I'm interested to establish the quantum of cases and determinations that would be overturned by the Social Welfare Appeals Office. So you make a determination in terms of insurability. The deciding officer makes a determination, and then you might just comment then on the quantum of cases and the proportion of cases that would be overturned, and the balance of the outcome. In the first instance, Ms. Gordon, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, it comes on. It's
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. For clarification, you mean in the specific area, contract of contract for services? Okay, so I'll give you a breakdown for the. The case is done in 2019 so far. I have it for 2018 as well.
That'll be useful, yeah, for comparative purposes. Yeah.
So over the two-year period, 29 appeals were brought by companies and 12 by workers. So that's the breakdown of 41. And in the period from January to October 2019, 19 decisions were determined by appeals officers, of which 14 appeals were brought by companies and 5 were appeals brought by workers. In 16 of these cases, the deciding officer of the department had determined that the employment status was Class A. I'm using Class A and Class S for ease of reference. And in 3 cases, the decision was that the employment status was Class S. In all 14 cases appealed by companies, the deciding officer determined that the employment status was Class A. The appeals officer determined Class A in 8 cases and Class S in 6 cases. Okay. In the 5 cases appealed by workers, the deciding officer determined that the employment status was Class A in 2 cases and Class S in 3 cases. The appeals officer determined that Class A applied in 3 cases and Class S applied in 2 cases. So, in fact, in that latter example, the appeals officer had changed the 2 Class A decisions to Class S and the 3 Class S to Class A. In the year 2018, a total of 22 decisions were determined by appeals officers, of which 15 were appeals brought by companies and 7 were appeals brought by workers. In 18 of these cases, the deciding officer had determined that the employment status was Class A and in 4 cases the decision was that the employment status was Class S. In all 15 cases appealed by companies, the deciding officer determined that the employment status was Class A. The appeals officer determined Class A in 11 cases and Class S in 4. In the 7 cases appealed by workers, the deciding officer determined that the employment status was Class A in 3 cases and Class S in 4 cases. The appeals officer determined that Class A applied in 4 cases and Class S applied in 3 cases. Therefore, the appeals officer changed 1 decision from Class S to Class A and upheld the deciding officer's decisions in the 6 other cases. So another way maybe of stating it, being successful or unsuccessful depends on the perspective, whether it's the company or the worker. But over the period from 2018 to 2019, companies were successful in 10 out of the 29 appeals brought by them, or 1/3, and workers were successful in 6 out of 12 appeals brought by them, roughly.
Okay, thanks. It would be very useful, actually, if we, as members of the committee, could actually get that breakdown, just to help us in our consideration of where we go next. Yeah, for comparative purposes. Ms. Gordon, are there any particular economic categories and sectors where you would find a high proportion of appeals? You know, is it construction? Is it, for example, courier class? Is it IT workers, or is it a mixed bag, to use that expression?
It is a mixed bag. The sectors covered, I have a list of them. Mainly the appeals tend to be one-person appeals. Of those, that's the figures that I gave you, one appeal had 4 people attached and the other had 3. I am aware of an earlier case not covered by 2018 or 2019 where there were 16 workers attached in this specific category. The sectors involved...
16 workers.
Construction.
Construction.
So the sectors involved in appeals, as it largely tend to be one-person appeals, cover media, journalism, construction, IT consultancy, project management, lecturing, catering, research and development, bookkeeping, retail, driving, car repairs, maintenance, aviation, and in the tourism services. It's not an exhaustive list, but many, as I say, are single cases. And we don't have many appeals in any particular sector where a number of workers are concerned or attached to an appeal.
Okay.
May I say, just in relation to the earlier years, we don't keep files. We don't have appeal-specific files. The file is actually the department's file, and it is returned once the appeal is determined. It's quite difficult to get the data without actually getting all of the files returned back to us and almost reading them again from scratch to see what was at issue. But we'll endeavour to provide stats for a few more years.
Yeah, I think it would be good practice, though, to keep that data. And is that something that you would be prepared to do? Is it something that you think is good practice?
Absolutely.
The increased activity from the department and the new unit that's been established, I think maintaining the data year on year, if the new unit is going to produce data that you could see where the trends are, would be a useful exercise.
Yeah, and that is our intention. Our management of files is quite old, let's put it that way, and it's quite limited in terms of how we can categorise, but we are actually modernising or in a project at the moment to build on the BOMI platform in the department, and in that context we do hope to be able to have better codification, and yes,
thank agreed. You. Senator Nash?
Yeah, reference to, and you'll understand why, because reference were made at the last hearing that we had by a witness, Mr. Martin McMahon, in relation to the presence of a number of what were described as test cases that it is being claimed have been used to determine the employment status en masse of those who work in the courier service and in the that sector of our economy. Now, we know that's a matter of contention for the department, and the department has consistently expressed the view that no such test cases or precedential cases exist, and both you and Mr. Duggan have claimed in your own statements that every case is considered on its own merits, and no reference that is made to this series of cases that I understand were considered back in 1995. Everything is considered, as you said, on a de novo basis. But you also endeavour to be, as you said yourselves, consistent in terms of the determinations that you make and the decisions that you make in terms of the appeals process. You'll be aware as well, because I know you would have received this information and the department would have over the years, that evidence was presented to the Public Accounts Committee and to the chair of the then Public Accounts Committee, the late Jim Mitchell, back in the year 2000, when the Controller and Auditor General was examining the phenomenon of false self-employment and the consequences for the Exchequer, when a then official, very senior official in the Department of Social Protection, made a reference to test cases. Now, you appear to be unequivocal that no such test cases or precedential cases exist in relation to couriers. That's at odds with what Mr McMahon, who has very considerable experience in this space, on the front line, as it were, said to us at the meeting. The reason I asked, I think I made the request that you appear before the committee today, was to obviously get under the bonnet of this issue, to understand how you work very clearly, but also as well to address those issues, because that's a very serious claim to make, and you appear to be challenging that. So I want to give you the opportunity to reflect on that and put on the record your own individual and the department's perspective on this, because this is a view that has been out there for a considerable period of time. It's a very serious issue. A view was taken and a view was expressed at the last meeting that clearly the Social Welfare Appeals Office or the Department of Social Protection can't in itself make law. Draw your attention to the John Grace Fried Chicken case, which saw the destruction of the then Joint Labour Committee system, and the courts were very clear that there's one lawmaking body in this republic, and that is the Houses of the Oireachtas. But an allegation is being made that, in essence, the Social Welfare Appeal Office is making law and using those precedential cases to inform your consideration of cases that are brought to your attention. That's a serious allegation. I want to give you the opportunity to address that. I think it's important that, yes, that you do. Yep. And you made it, and then, if I may, with your permission, Chair, ask Mr Duggan some broad questions in relation to the process.
Ms Gordon, yeah, address that issue specifically. Okay. Yeah. First, please.
Thank you, Senator, and I am happy to have the opportunity to clarify and set out my understanding. You'll appreciate I can't speak an individual case for reasons of confidentiality and data protection. What I can say is that our office does not use test cases. We do not use test cases. And in the particular case referred to, I was not even aware that of this case existed and had to go to find it. And in looking and doing the research for this meeting, it's my understanding that the precedent case that is being referred to dates back to 1995 and an appeals officer's decision sometime in June. And I want to say we do not use this or any other case as a precedent or as a decision.
Oh, if I may interject, the former Secretary General of the Department, in correspondence to the PAC,
yep,
in 2000, made reference to, yep, test cases.
Yep.
So you're
I was going to comment on that. And it is the case that, again, I didn't have this particular letter, but I made it my business to find it. It is the case that the Secretary General of the Department, in correspondence to the Chairman of the Public Accounts Committee in October 2000, made reference to a number of representative test cases that were selected in 1993-94 for investigation and formal decision. And I assume that was decision by deciding officers, and some or one or two made their way to the appeal process. And that process resulted in a decision by an appeals officer in June 1995, who decided, I presume among other things, that a worker in a particular sector was self-employed if they provided their own vehicle and equipment, were responsible for expenses including taxes, insurance, maintenance, and payment was made on the basis of rate per job. The Secretary General at that time also outlined that the appeals officer's decision established the criteria that was generally accepted in relation to the employment status of workers in that sector. However, the Secretary-General also made reference to subsequent discussion, or discussions even, with trade union representatives in relation to the insurability of workers in that sector in the context of the Programme for Prosperity and Fairness. It would seem, and it's my understanding, that the outcome of these discussions was the establishment of the Employment Status Group, which developed the Code of Practice for Determining Employment and Self-Employment, which was drawn up in 2001. That code was prepared by the group on a tripartite basis, set up under the Programme for Prosperity and Fairness, in response to concerns that some individuals were categorised as self-employed when the indicators were that employee status may be more appropriate, and the objective of the code was to eliminate misconceptions and provide clarity. So the code has postdated the 1995 decision. Our decisions in the Appeals Office in relation to the insurability of workers are made by reference to the code and the abundance of principles and legal principles emerging from the case law of the courts are not made by reference to that test case or any test case. Obviously, we do strive to be consistent, but that consistency is achieved in this area by reference to using the code and the principles emerging from the court. And what I've set out is my understanding. I can't obviously speak for the department, but that's my understanding, and I want to categorically say we do not use secret precedent cases, any precedent cases, or we do not use this specific 1995 decision.
So you're saying categorically that, and you know, let's put cards on the table, that this applied to workers in the courier sector. So you're telling me now quite categorically that if a courier has a concern over their insurability and their employment status, that they take a case in the normal way to scope for determination. If they're not satisfied with that, they can appeal that to the Social Welfare Appeals Office. And your view is that that's treated on a de novo basis. The facts of the matter are considered based on its own merits, and the application of law, case law, your own experience, and in the interest of consistency and so on. But there are no, as far as you're concerned, precedential test cases that are used to inform your decisions. That's what you're saying categorically.
That is what I'm saying categorically. And should anybody in any sector appeal a decision, that decision is absolutely based on the facts of its own case. And, you know, sometimes cases look the same or similar, but actually when you start applying the principles and take evidence, sometimes it can be different. And that's why it is important that each case is determined on the facts pertaining in that particular case. All decisions are made by reference to the code and to the case law of the courts.
Just got a couple of final questions, so, if I can, to Mr. Duggan, if that's... I've been actively seeking to address some of the concerns that I have and the trade union movement have and individual workers in relation to false self-employment. And I'm probably as familiar, well, maybe not as familiar, but certainly acquainted with the figures and the trends over the last 15 to 20 years. And they were very helpfully produced as well in the report in terms of the social welfare, or PRSI, and tax implications, the report that was published, I think it was in early 2018, maybe, if my memory serves me correct. And Mr. Duggan, you're on record there as saying that the figures around self-employment remain broadly similar over an extended period of time. And of course that we all know that those who are at risk, if I can put it like that, and those who would attract our attention in terms of potential false self-employment status and the miscategorisation of their status are those who are self-employed with no employees, and I absolutely understand that. I understand and appreciate that the figures from the CSO, as they are stable. I get that, I understand that, but I don't think that there should ever be an acceptable number of people who are falsely self-employed, because they are individuals who, by their actions and because they are encouraged or in some cases forced to be self-employed, there's a fraud being perpetrated on the state. Workers have been deprived of the benefits that they would otherwise be entitled to, and they're also being deprived of their rights as workers. And because numbers just appear to be stable, shouldn't mean that we don't act. And I'm pleased that action is taking place, but I won't be satisfied until we see some clear legislative action, because I think, as the system essentially has acknowledged, the code of practice that's in place at the moment is not fit for purpose and hasn't kept pace with developments in recent years. I won't be satisfied. I don't believe that the system will change. I don't believe that workers will be protected, the state will be protected, until such time as we include in future legislation the updated statutory code. And I'd be interested when the time is right to obviously establish precisely what that wants to do. And I understand that the Minister may be interested in drawing some provisions from legislation I published myself, and that was unfortunately defeated at committee stage, to Shannon, maybe introducing that into some elements of that into proposed legislation. But I'll say this, just like one simple question. For the life of me, I find it difficult to ascertain how, with the best will in the world, we can protect those who take cases to the scope section against victimisation from their employer, because it is very difficult to protect somebody who is self-employed from victimisation because they don't have the status of employee. I've had these discussions with people in the sector, and I'd appreciate if you could elaborate precisely how you're going to do that, because my understanding is that when an individual takes a case to scope in terms of their insurability and the determination of their status, that the presumption is that they're self-employed until otherwise determined. So it's very difficult to protect somebody's interests and protect somebody against victimisation if they're not, at least from your perspective, an employee at that point in time. So you might just elaborate a little on how you propose to do that, because that would be an important feature of the process going forward.
Thank you, Senator Nash. Mr. Duggan.
Thank you, Senator. I wholeheartedly agree with you that there is no such thing as an acceptable number of people who are falsely self-employed, which is why I specifically refer to that in my opening statement by saying, regardless of what the figures are showing us, we're going after this, because it is important. I'm not sure I fully agree with you by saying that the Code of Practice isn't fit for purpose. We are updating it to make sure that it is as modern and as up-to-date as it's possible to be in reflecting the case law that has emerged since it was last done in 2007, and to ensure that it incorporates significant advances that have been made through that case law in that intervening dozen years or so. So, for instance, mutuality of obligation has become the critical determining factor now as a result of that case law, and consequently the new guidance will reflect that largely. It's also...
is actually inserted into our primary law. That's my own view. We may differ on that, and we'll have that debate on the floor of the Shannon on the Dáil when the proposed legislation is presented.
Opportunity to conclude.
Indeed. It will set out very clearly for employers and employees how this is a key critical issue, and they have to pay attention to it. And when that new guidance is put on a statutory footing, it'll be put on a statutory footing on the basis that deciding officers will have to have regard to it. So it'll be very clear to all employers and employees that when deciding officers in scope are examining cases that are referred to them, they will be doing it in the context of that guidance. And consequently, to ignore that guidance and what it specifically sets out wouldn't be prudent. You are right that there is a difficulty about defining an employee when somebody is categorised as self-employed. And we're currently teasing through with the Office of the Attorney General precisely how we'll frame that anti-victimisation legislation. But it'll have to incorporate something around when an individual or a worker is engaged with scope in seeking a determination of their status. And that's still being worked out, and obviously once we have it worked out, it'll be obvious how we think we can address that specific issue you've raised. It's not easy, I accept, but we are definitively going to try and do that.
Thank you, Mr. Duggan. Senator Higgins.
Yes, thank you very much. So, just to pick up on just a few of the discussion points, I would say perhaps have a small, again, disagreement with my colleague, Senator Nash. The department, as you rightly then pointed out, hasn't actually been consistent because we do have that 2000 statement from the Secretary General at the time. And I'm interested to hear the change in policy that you're telling us came about in 2001. But the fact is we do have a correspondence, extensive correspondence actually, correspondence from the Secretary General of the department at the time, in which they're very clear that they are using test cases. They name, he calls them test cases. And he sets in place three specific measures: providing own vehicle and equipment, response for all expenses, payment made on the basis of rate per job plus mileage allowance. So there's kind of it's a very specific group ruling. So you're telling us then that in 2001, I think, that a different approach came into place. And I'm curious of what was done in terms of redressing the concerns for those who had been impacted, because these cases go back into the 90s. And we have the concern, many of the cases that we've been discussing and many of the concerns have been raised go back into the 90s. And that's why, with respect, Chair, while we were offered figures from 2018 and 2019, I think it would be very useful if we could get figures going back as far as possible, because this isn't a recently arising. 2018 and 2019, when come at a point when there was already considerable public scrutiny on the area. We have in 2001 this change in policy, as you're saying, where these new guidelines came in. I'd be interested in what happened in terms of redressing concerns around the inappropriate use of test cases in the years previous to that. I'd also have some concern, because there's a kind of a contradiction I'm seeing in the presentations, where we've had this very heart kind of felt reassurance that every case is looked at individually, etc. But Ms. Gordon, you also in your presentation say that there's nothing in the law to, it is not that you say there's no legislative provision provides for appeals officers to make decisions on the groups or classes of workers. However, it is also the case that the legislation does not preclude such an approach. Now, my understanding is that the legislation does preclude such an approach. You know, we have the Denny case and we have other cases. And again, we've been hearing that every case is dealt with individually. So I'm just curious about the contradiction within your own presentation, where you're suggesting that the legislation would allow you to look at the employment status of groups or classes of workers. I note you mentioned as well that during your time as Chief Appeals Officer in 2015, the classification of a worker as an employer, self-employed, hasn't been the approach adopted. But I know, and you mentioned this indirectly, an appeals officer proposed this approach. You were obviously referring, I think, to the 2016 case where a group case was proposed by an appeals officer. So it's quite recently been the practice. And in that case, as I understand it, the employees objected. I just wanted to go to related question, and then I'll come back with a separate.
Yeah, if you want, but
a last related one, because it ties into the legal question, the question of cases. We've had references a lot to case law and case precedent. Do you think that the change in 1992, so in 1992, where we moved from a situation whereby somebody appealing a scope decision would take that to the courts, and in 1992 it moved and we changed the system, whereby now they're appealing to your own office in terms of the appeals office. Does that deprive us of some good case law in this area? Because we have previously an area where we would be developing case law, where people would be tested, and suddenly instead it went to a somewhat more opaque process in terms of locating the decisions being located within the appeals office internal to the department.
Ms. Gordon.
Thank you, Senator. So just in relation to the 1995 test cases and what changed, first I want to clarify that this is my understanding. I can't speak for the department. I've only gleaned these documents in the last two or three weeks. I think what had changed. So I'm not familiar. I do not know what happened in 1993-94 in terms of the test cases. I think it may have been done in consultation with trade union representatives, but I can't be certain about that because I wasn't there at that particular time. I think what did change in 2001, and I think it's evident from the letter that the Secretary General wrote to the Public Accounts Committee, it seems to me that the outcome of these later discussions, sometime between 1995 and 2000, was the establishment of the Employment Status Group under the Programme for Prosperity and Fairness, and that the product of that work was actually the code, which, you know, actually reflects, I think, those three things. I mean, there were three very small factors that were highlighted, but I think the code, if one read it, I mean, there are more factors and indicators there. These would feature in some way or other within the code. So to, as far as I know, but I'm open to correction on this, from what I can see is that the change was the establishment of the group in 2001, which itself drew up the code on the tripartite basis. I think it was originally drawn up in 2001 under the banner of the Programme for Prosperity and Fairness. I really can't be any clearer than that because I can't say I know any more about that. In relation to the groups or classes and that they are precluded, I mean, there is no specific provision in the legislation which says one can't. And I was asked in one particular case, I wouldn't be proposing it. I was asked, in the area of contract offer, contract for services, but there were some 40 workers involved, and it was the exact same issue. The only issue that was to be determined on appeal was the same in all cases. So that would, you know, the approach was it would be somewhat of a waste of time to hear all 40 when it is this issue. And I would only do that with the agreement of the workers and the companies concerned. If, however, any person or worker said, well, actually, I don't want my appeal to be done in that way, I want mine to be done separately, they absolutely would have their appeal determined individually. They absolutely would. In the case you referred to, yes, it was a 2016 case, and there was some, I think, 16 workers. It was proposed because it is an efficient way of dealing with when it's the exact same appeal contention. If it's the same thing across 20 or 30 people, it can be an efficient way of dealing with the issue. But each individual, I should stress, is entitled to an individual decision and can still invoke all of the other provisions in the Act in terms of review under Section 317 in light of new facts or evidence, or review by me under Section 318 in error factor law. So they're not, the other avenues of redress are not closed to the person.
But you mentioned that there was no legislation that says you can't, but there's legal decision that says you can't. And you've told us that the decisions are being made based on the principles and the legal decisions that are coming down through the courts. So again, this, for me, do you not think this points to perhaps the appropriate place for decisions being made is the courts in relation to appeals? If the appeals office is not aware of cases in the 90s and is not aware of key legal decisions, such as the Denny decision, which affects it.
No, sorry, I have to say we are aware of all of the principles emerging from the courts, and I have had a chapter in my 2015 annual report where I set out the key principles from the courts. And absolutely, yeah, no, I agree. The courts have said that you must look at the circumstances in the individual case, but there can be cases where the circumstances are actually the same or very similar. But if there are different circumstances, two, three people, and the circumstances of their case are different, then absolutely, they each will get an appeal hearing.
It just
hearing.
Seems with such a low volume of cases moving through, that it would be appropriate to be getting them right in each case.
Yeah, and in the absolute majority of cases, to be honest, I think I'm only aware of that one case where there were 16 workers and it was the same issue. But as I said, and as you know, they weren't happy. in relation to 1992, I'm not sure I understood the question in terms of what it
previously
changed.
An appeal to a decision made, for example, by the scope, and it would go to the High Court. The decision 1992 is that it would move to instead an appeals office located within the department. Yeah. So my question is, are we losing effectively quality High Court decisions in relation to that, because these decisions, instead of being played out in our court system or in a very transparent way, are effectively taking place within the appeals office?
I'm not aware of these specific appeals going directly to the courts. The office was set up in 1990 as such, in that appeals officers were given statutory functions. I can't remember which particular act, but each person can still appeal an appeals officer's decision or the revised decision of the Chief Appeals Officer to the High Court on a question of law. I'm not aware of cases. I mean, obviously, there are some of our cases have ended up in court and in the High Court and in the Supreme Court. Denny and Barry and Neen, and there's a whole plethora of case law. But I'm not aware of ones that where the scope decision went directly to the courts.
Could I just... I'm going to come back in a moment into how, given the changes in 2001, what steps might have been taken to redress the problems that had taken place in the 90s. But just to go to Mr. Duggan for a minute, and this relates to, I guess, that question of the principles on which decisions are being made. You mentioned the principle of mutual obligation. Now, and there's an interesting... The presentation from the scope unit... And again, with the scope unit, we've kind of a lot of clarity around how they make decisions, there's transparency, and I think it's a really important note, again, Mr. Duggan, when you suggested that the figures weren't compelling, a very interesting testimony from within the department itself related to the question of why so few cases are being put forward. And this is from the department, from the scope unit itself. They specifically named the fact that when they did an appeal, they were getting 8 queries a day, but very few turning into cases, and specifically, they said, fear of repercussions. And that is the reality in the situation, and that is, you know, literally identified in the presentation to this committee as one of the key strong findings by scope that they found people were, quote from it here, I want to be just accurate, it says, evidence that people want anonymity and fear repercussions as one of the key obstacles to this issue being tackled. So again, I just want to say, when we say it's not compelling, I think it is compelling if we have workers in a climate of fear in Ireland who can't take cases forward. You mentioned mutuality of obligation as something you were considering bringing in, but the scope unit, like over a year ago, maybe it's even 2 years ago, no, it was November 2018, mutuality of obligation is already the principle on which scope are making their decisions. Is it the case that the appeals office are considering bringing in mutuality of obligation? Because that seemed to be the suggestion that we might see it in the new code based on some new case law.
No, so to get to the last point first, it's not that we're considering bringing it in. It's that mutuality of obligation has been determined by courts to be the primary determining factor in employment status. And all I said we're doing is updating that guidance to ensure that that's covered comprehensively. Because in the previous version that was issued in 2007, it wasn't. But that doesn't mean that scope section and the appeals office haven't been operating on the basis of the case law that has been handed down over the past decades. They have. So mutuality of obligation has been a feature for quite some considerable time in the determination of employment status by scope deciding officers and by appeals officers. All I was referring to was an updating of the guidance to ensure that it was covered comprehensively.
You mentioned the guidance that you think the code may go onto a statutory basis next year. In terms of the statutory basis, will that code, or will it also address... or look to address the corporate structures? So this is, for example, in relation to the aviation industry. We heard very strong testimony in the course of our hearings of this committee of the use, effectively, of false company structures and so forth to hide the fact of people being self-employed, and in correspondence as well in relation to the revenue have identified this as an area that would require legislative action to address, because at the moment in any code there's no capacity for investigating such company or corporate structures. Is that something that you anticipate to be addressed at the time when a new code is put onto a statutory basis?
Yeah, the new guidance will have a section on it dealing with the use of intermediary arrangements, and that includes personal service companies and managed service companies. So there will be sections dealing with those, and there will be a section dealing with the identifying of the employer for PRSI purposes in such contexts. So that will be covered in the guidance.
And could I just ask, in terms of follow-up, so in cases where people are found to be misclassified, and we know that, for example, there were inspections by revenue in relation to the construction sector, and there's others, but what steps have ever been taken by the department in terms of reclaiming PRSI, either singly or in respect of, in cooperation with revenue, in terms of ensuring that we have, you know, because it is a huge loss to the state if we have widespread practices. And just as an example of that widespread practice, I do want to correct something. Just, Ms. Gordon, you suggested perhaps it was the unions who pushed for those test cases at the time. We can definitely clarify, because it was also part of the 2000 correspondence to the PAC committee at the time, that representatives of the couriers industry, so again, not of one company, of the industry, were in correspondence and engagement with revenue at the time, and revenue have confirmed that. So it would certainly seem that this was an industry-led push for categorisation, because they were engaged in the same process with revenue.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Duggan, do you want to refer back to the first point that the Senator raised?
Yeah, when a determination is made of employee rather than self-employed status, the social welfare inspector involved calculates the PRSI arrears that are due and issues a notice to the employer to discharge that liability, and that is followed up.
And is it followed up retrospectively?
Senator, just one second. Is it in terms of the adjustment, is it then put back onto the employee's record? Do they get
those
contributions?
Yes, absolutely. The contribution record of the employee is
amended as well.
Yeah, it is.
Can you give us any sense of what would have been recovered in terms of quantum of monies over the last couple of years, you know, on the trend, 2017, 2018, if that's available? And if not, you might actually forward it to the committee.
If you don't have it, you can forward it.
Well, say, for instance, from employer investigations to date this year, the savings from that are just shy of 1.9 million. That's up to the end of October.
When you mean savings, is that money recovered as a direct result?
The calculation of PRSI that has not been paid as a result of the misclassification.
Okay.
And some other things as well. So in some cases, it might be that PRSI wasn't paid at all, or was miscalculated, or some elements of it were miscalculated. So it's a combination.
Senator Higgins, are you...
I wanted to just follow up a question from Ms. Gordon, and then a wider question, which is, so in relation to those cases that were kind of taking place between the test cases of 93-94 and the decision to move to a different approach in 2001, were steps taken in relation to cases, decisions that may have been made, and it seems they clearly were, judging from the Secretary General of 2000, on the basis of test cases during that period, to be reviewed and to be looked back on in terms of if it was then determined that the use of test cases was inappropriate, were steps taken to redress the problems between 95 and 2000? And then just a separate question also, Ms. Gordon, is what would you say are the five key principles that you are applying in relation to a review or an appeal of decision? Because Scope were very clear about the principles they apply and what they use to base their decisions on. Perhaps for the appeals office, what would you say are the five or six key principles?
Ms. Gordon.
Thank you. Just going back to the 1993-94 test cases, I mean, I've put this note together for myself, but some of this is within the department's domain, so I don't really know is the answer to that.
Mr. Duggan can answer either if it's...
All I can say, as I said, is to me, reading the chronology of events, is that clearly there was a decision or agreement made that a number of cases in a particular sector would be determined based on sample cases or test cases. At least one, if not more, made their way to the appeal system. Subsequently, as I say, the employment status group, which was set up under the Programme for Prosperity and Fairness, it seems to me that the development of the code overtook, probably, or superseded anything that happened before that. In terms of reviewing those decisions, you know, a person can request a review of an appeals officer's decision under Section 317 of the Social Welfare Act in light of new facts or evidence, or under Section 318, can write to the Chief Appeals Officer and ask for a review if they consider an error of fact or law has occurred.
If somebody's already exhausted that within the period where the department were using, can they reuse 317, 318?
With 317, 318 actually don't have time limit on it, so it can be requested at any time. The caveat I would put on it is that if a Chief Appeals Officer at that time had done a review, that would be the end of the process.
So that's, I think, the concern. So it's just a direct question. Don't you think perhaps steps might need to be taken if there was a concern in relation to law that was obviously held across the department, given that it was the view of the Secretary General at the highest level between 1995 and 2001, those who may have exhausted the decision process at the time, but then later, even through the work of the Employment Status Group, have been determined to, in fact, have been correct in their concern. You know, so you can see there is a concern around that.
Thank you, Senator.
Does 317, 318 need to be opened again for people during that period of time?
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Duggan, do you want to comment on this?
Perhaps the following might help clarify. I think there's a somewhat misunderstanding of test cases. We don't use that phrase anymore. Essentially, they were sample cases at the time. So there was an effort at the time where there was a particular sector being looked at, and efforts were made to try and streamline the process in the sense of trying to get greater administrative efficiency to make decisions for people. But that doesn't change any of the things we've said in terms of principles. All decisions are individual, and anybody at any time can seek a review of such decision or can seek an appeal of such decision, and can use the various mechanisms that the Chief Appeals Officer has set out in terms of that appeal, 317, 318, and subsequently on to court if they so wish. So there's no precedential value at all to those sample cases that were examined in the 90s. None whatsoever, in the sense anyone can look for theirs to be dealt with individually. And what happened in 2001 wasn't a change of policy, because the policy was exactly what I've just said all along. What happened from 2001 on was a greater rigour being put into how people would know about these things. So those negotiations, that working group, resulted ultimately in the first version of the Code of Practice, which subsequently was revised following further consideration in 2007, and now is being further revised as we speak because of developments in the case law since 2007.
So, I'm sorry, Mr. Duggan, that does actually contradict the statement. So previously we've been consistent with the narrative, but that's inconsistent. So we have the Secretary General in October 2000 saying that some couriers consider themselves self-employed, others regard themselves as employees. In order to resolve the matter, a number of representative test cases were selected in 1993-94 for detailed investigation and a formal insurability decision under social welfare legislation. The process resulted in the decisions who decided that a courier was self-employed if he provided his own vehicle and equipment, was responsible for all expenses, including tax insurance, and payment was made on the rate basis of rate per hour plus mileage. So that's clearly not individual decision makings. It's literally saying there are different kinds of cases and different opinions. We want to resolve the fact of there being different opinions and different individual cases. And here's how we've decided to resolve it through these test cases. So I just think it's fine to move on. And I think it's great to move on. But let's not retrospectively recreate the process.
Senator,
that is not inconsistent with what I said at all. Sample cases that were taken to deal with a specific issue at that specific time. And they do not have precedential value for any other cases, even cases in the same case, in the same set of circumstances. So, for instance, if a courier were to approach scope section tomorrow morning and seek a determination of their employment status, it would be considered, to use the Chief Appeals Officer phrase, de novo, from the very beginning. The particular circumstances of that person's working environment would be the consideration in conjunction with the guidance and the case law that has emerged.
Yeah, that's true now, but I'm talking
about
that period
as well.
Between...
Senator,
you've made that point.
I know, but I'm saying I haven't been satisfied with the answer in
you
that...
You might not be satisfied with the answer, but you got the answer.
I've clearly described the test cases. Just the question on the key principles...
Thank you. I understand the question, Senator, is what principles I would use in determining if a contract of or contract for services. Well, I suppose I can do no better than what the courts have said and told us. And the courts have found that the determination of the appropriate insurability classification must be arrived at by looking at what a person actually does, the way in which it is done, and the terms and conditions under which the person is engaged, be they written, verbal or implied. And it is clear from the relevant case law that there is no one factor which may be taken as determinative of either a contract of or a contract of services. Well, I understand the mutuality of obligation test has taken some precedence probably in some recent jurisprudence. So reflecting the precedence from the court, the code of practice places an emphasis also on the need to look at the job as a whole, including the working conditions and the reality of the working relationship when considering the nature of the employment relationship. And the code states, or the previous code, existing code, I guess it still is, states that the overriding test will always be whether the person performing the work does so as a person in business on their own account. So the four main tests, and you asked me for five, but the four main tests for establishing the difference between a contract of service and a contract for services that have evolved from the case law of the courts, I think can be summarised as the control test. Is the person under the control of another person who directs as to how, when and where the work is to be carried out? The integration test, has the worker become part and parcel of the organisation? The test of mutuality of obligation, is there a mutual obligation between the parties to provide and accept the work offered? And as I said, the test of economic reality. This test, in my view, probably incorporates all of the above to establish whether the worker is in business on his or her own account.
So they're very similar criteria to the scope unit, which is just why
they would be the same. And there is a high degree of judgment in these cases, which, and you know, the courts have said that, you know, in these cases, inevitably there will be elements of contract of and contract for services. Sometimes it can be finely balanced, and really there is a high degree of judgment to be made in determining whether it's contract of or contract for service.
It's just
the same criteria.
There's such a degree of change in the decisions. It's quite a high degree in terms of appeals, successful appeals in this area. So that's why I'm surprised that it is exactly the same criteria. Could I just ask, I don't ask you for the sector, but in relation to individually, because one of the areas that we've been looked at, well, two of the areas we've looked at, and you mentioned one of them, are aviation and also the courier industry. There are two areas where there's been a sectoral concern. I'm just wondering, in relation to, has there been determinations of persons being found to be employees through both the scope process and the appeals process in relation to each of those industries?
Thank you, Senator.
Is there precedent? Is there findings?
Thank you. Actually, I haven't seen any cases in the courier sector in So I wouldn't necessarily see all of them. We do get some 20,000 appeals registered each year, but I'm not aware of any in recent years, so I'm hazarding a guess that there aren't any decisions in that particular sector. And in the aviation sector, no, not there is one case ongoing, but it's not finalised.
Very final question, just the role of the courts. Do you see a key role in terms of the court? Because one of the proposals that was put to the committee was that potentially there may be a better role for the courts if we look
through... Thank you, Senator.
What do you see as that?
Ms. Gordon?
As an alternative route.
As an alternative. I suppose the courts have been highly complimentary of the appeals process and have said routinely that decision makers both in the department and in the appeals office are probably the experts in this area and have been reluctant to disturb findings of fact on either decision makers. There are routes within the legislation as it currently exists where a person can appeal on a point of law to the High Court. There is provision under 306 where I can refer a question to the High Court. I haven't found that necessary within the confines of the legislation, which requires that I would find it necessary. I do think that both deciding officers and appeals officers really, in above any other area, are so guided by precedents that have come from the court. There's probably no other area in the social welfare code that has such an abundance of case law surrounding it. So it's probably not necessary to refer, and I probably would expect that the court would send it back to me, as sometimes they might, and say, resubmit and have an appeals officer make the decision.
And just my last question, Mr. Duggan, that culture, that issue of fear, in terms of the fear within persons who may be self-employed or bogus self-employed, what steps are the department taking to address that issue of fear in the sector and the identified concern of scope?
Mr. Duggan did address this previously, but if you...
The fear, that specific issue.
First of all, I mentioned in my opening statement how we're endeavouring to develop new legislation to provide for people to take cases to the WRC where they feel they're being victimised. And we absolutely intend to progress that. There are some small difficulties with it, as the Senator earlier highlighted, but we are seeking to address those. So that is definitively on the roadmap for early in the new year to progress that. We hope that will be immensely helpful for anyone who is in fear of making a request for a determination to scope section. We've also done some communications exercises in the past, and we intend to repeat those, and we will specifically be highlighting that particular aspect and trying to give people assurance that they will be protected through these new legislative measures that we intend to bring in. So we hope the combination of the two of those would help people to feel more assured that they will be protected in the event that they seek a determination.
Thank you. Before we conclude, do any of our witnesses want to make any final remarks or comments?
I'm happy enough.
Okay. Just before we conclude, I just want to make an observation. I did notice that the original presentation to this committee was November of last year. And it is interesting, in my view, that the presentation today has moved forward more positively, where you have increased the staff at the scope section, where you have established the new unit, and where you're talking about introducing legislation, around that to protect people if they're taking cases, WRC and so forth. So, it's a different presentation than we received a year ago, and there have been positive steps forward, and I think it would be remiss of the committee not to acknowledge that. There are issues, obviously, you've heard them raised today, but there has been, in my view, very... very clear steps of an improvement to address a problem that sometimes the department were reluctant or maybe didn't see the scale of it, and I know we might disagree on it, but you have taken positive steps, and I want to acknowledge that. To our witnesses, Ms. Dowling, Mr. Duggan, Ms. Gordon and Mr. Duff, thank you for your presentation and the direct and forthright manner in which you answered questions. Colleagues, that concludes the business of today, so we stand adjourned. Thank you.